Good morning. That was quite a voice, wasn't it? To start with, a cracking. Hopefully we'll be okay. It is good to be with you and to have an opportunity to speak once again. There's something that's been in the news recently that's gained my attention. You may have heard of this particular news story, or you may not have, I don't know. But there's a group called the American Atheists who have recently put up message boards in a few different cities across the country. Some of them that I understand are in Memphis and Nashville, St. Louis, Fort Smith, Arkansas, and Milwaukee are the ones that I've seen mentioned at least, where these billboards have been put up. Well, if it comes from the American Atheists, chances are you and I aren't necessarily agreeing with it. You can kind of imagine what it may say. And there's a part of me that hesitates to give it even the credibility to speak of it and to mention it. But yet, sometimes we speak of positive things, and sometimes we learn from negative things that are out there as well. This billboard has a picture of a young girl. And the young girl has just written a letter to Santa Claus. And in the letter to Santa Claus, she says, "Dear Santa, all I want for Christmas is to skip church. I'm too old for fairy tales." Well, in our lesson this morning, we're going to continue talking, but what we're going to do is hopefully turn the idea of fairy tale on its head. And we'll discover that there's another aspect that is a fairy tale. But we'll get to that when the time allows. But the thing about this is, you know, I don't know that messages like this on billboards create more atheists, but I think these messages do tend to weaken faith. If you think about and you compare the faith of our society today with the faith of society one or two generations ago, I think in some ways it's weaker now. Not saying ours is, or there's many people whose faith has not been changed at all. But today, society continues to hear so many different messages, and they don't really know what message to listen to, and they become very confused. I think there's a lot of people that are still very willing and open to be convicted of things about God, but as they hear all these different messages, they don't know where to turn. And one of the challenges in today's society is that as tolerance and diversity have been elevated to almost worship-like status among some, then almost any idea becomes valuable. And it has helped atheists to gain credibility, the ideas that they propose. But what we need to do is, as we are able to talk to those who are certainly willing to be convicted, we need to always be ready to have an answer to those who ask. To every man who asks you a reason of the hope that's in you, with meekness and fear. And so what we're doing today is continuing to help us to be equipped to address these kinds of situations. You know, two things that have kind of struck me is, number one, the billboards as those are around the country now. Also, I've recently read an article entitled "Seven Reasons to Believe in God." Now, this article is in the October 2014 edition of an online religious publication called Reason and Revelation. Now, I've read this publication for several years. This isn't just one that I happen to run across. It is one that I've seen to have strong credibility. And what they do is often take fairly complicated topics and they expand on them quite a bit and help to make it understandable. And so this morning, I'm not giving a lesson on seven reasons to believe in God. We don't really have time for all seven in this case for the sermon possibilities, but I'm entitling mine Five Reasons to Believe in God. And some of these ideas, actually the main points, do come from this particular article. Some of the other comments I make will come from there, and then of course much of it will come from my own thoughts in this as well. But I put some things on the board in relation to this. One of the things that I appreciate about this article is that it says some things in a very powerful way with very few words. Rather than just unfolding them one at a time, I'm going to go ahead and at least show all five, briefly discuss them, and kind of then go into a little bit more detail about each one. But in terms of five reasons to believe in God, matter demands a maker. Life demands a life giver. Design demands a designer. Intelligence demands an intelligent creator. Morality demands a moral lawgiver. This allows you to kind of see what the whole idea is and kind of to be able to contemplate it along the way. One of the things I appreciate about this is you'll notice this kind of covers many of the different aspects of creation or of how life came to be. Here we're talking about matter itself as it came to be. Then how would life itself become formed? How did it originate? Of course, the matter that's there, how was it designed? Intelligence, how is intelligence gained? And morality. So again, I appreciate these five areas, and I appreciate that it's in very few words, volumes are spoken. And so we're going to take the time this morning to go through some of this. Matter demands a maker. First, we might briefly describe what matter is, and I didn't try to go into a major scientific definition, but the very first definition I found, I believe, is sufficient. Matter is anything that takes up space and has mass. Matter is anything that takes up space and has mass. And so, pretty much anything around us that takes up space and has mass is matter. So what can matter be? Some of the examples we might think of. Matter can be so small that you have to have a microscope to be able to see it. Matter can be as big as an elephant. Or even bigger, it can be a mansion. Or even bigger, matter can be as big as the planet Earth. Matter can be as big as the Milky Way galaxy. So we see matter can be small or great. But matter has a maker. And that's what all of these have in common, that they are in some way made. You know, if we think about examples that we may see or consider on a regular basis. Today we're standing in a building, or I'm standing, I guess you're sitting in a building. Some of you can remember 40 years ago or so when this building was constructed. Before that time, was there anything on this space? If you would have come in this space, you would have seen blank. You would be able to see straight through here because there wasn't anything here. But for those of you who were a part of the congregation about 40 years ago, you can vouch this building was made because you helped construct it. As I understand it, several of the members of the congregation here played a vast role and maybe did all the work, probably did all the work in terms of building this. So here's simply one example of something that was made. As you drive home today, you're going to pass buildings, stores, houses. You're going to drive on roads that were all made. Did these roads just suddenly appear? Did something just come from nothing? These matters, if you will, were made. And yet when it comes to the earth itself, what do some people have us believe? That somehow this earth came from nothing. Some would say 14 billion years ago or so, there was a small mass. And there was a great explosion. And out of that great explosion, that big bang, Earth came to be. Well, even if that were true, where did that small mass come from? Matter comes from somewhere. Matter has a maker. One of the comments that I've seen from Richard Dawkins, was a well-known atheist, or is a well-known atheist, I believe. He was involved in a panel discussion in 2012 in Australia on national TV. He was asked in this discussion how it is that something as enormous as the universe came from nothing. Here's my understanding of his response. Of course, it is counterintuitive that you can get something from nothing. Of course, common sense doesn't allow you to get something from nothing. That's why it's interesting. It's got to be interesting in order to give rise to the universe at all. Something pretty mysterious had to give rise to the origin of the universe. So what we see is it's clear that at one point this universe didn't exist. At some point matter came into existence. But since matter isn't eternal, since it can't create itself from nothing, then something from outside this universe created it. Something brought matter into existence. The cause of the universe can't be explained in any adequate way without understanding there is a supreme being who created it. I appreciate Romans chapter 1 and what it brings to this idea. If you'd like to turn there, you may. I'm going to read about four verses from Romans chapter 1. Verses that you're probably familiar with, but I think it speaks to this idea. Romans chapter 1 will begin with verse 19 through verse 23. We'll go ahead and go back to verse 18 as well. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness or suppress the truth. We've got the truth that's mentioned here. As we go on, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it to them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. I'll pause for a moment there. The invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen. The universe itself, earth itself, is clearly seen. And yet people say that it came from nothing. Verse 21, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like unto corruptible man, and to birds, and to four-footed beasts, and to creeping things. So they didn't give God the glory. They changed this glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like unto corruptible men. And here, of course, we're talking about idols and idol worship as they created these idols. You know, and I don't know positively if we could say that evolution is an idol. In my mind, in a sense, you could take the idea of the teaching of evolution and you could say it in itself is similar to this and would fall under the idea of an idol or idolatry. Now that could be debated, but I believe that that's something to consider as we read through that as well. But one of the major things to remember from this is that matter requires a maker. Just as matter demands a maker, so life demands a life giver. I appreciate how the Bible tells us life came into being. Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. And the Lord God did what? Formed man out of the dust of the ground, and did what? Breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And what happened? Man became a living being. So how did life come into existence? God shares it with us. In the book of Genesis, chapter 2, verse 7, he says life. He tells there about breathing into the nostrils of Adam, and he became a living being. And yet those who profess to be wise, they don't accept this simple explanation of life. But one of the things we find is that scientists do readily acknowledge that life comes from previous life. I'm going to just mention three different scientists that have mentioned this, three different evolutionists, kind of going through the years. Starting in 1933, evolutionist John Sullivan said, "It became an accepted doctrine that life never arises except from life." So to have life, there is a previous life, we find. Observational science has also reached the same conclusions, experiment after experiment, year after year. 1965, evolutionist George Gaylord Simpson says, "There is no serious doubt that biogenesis is the rule, that life comes only from other life, that a cell, the unit of life, is always and exclusively the product or offspring of another cell." And more recently, in 2009, Neil Subin, an evolutionist, proclaimed, and there's a few sentences here, "I can share with you one true law that we all agree on. The law is so profound that we take it completely for granted, yet it is a starting point for almost everything we do in paleontology, developmental biology, and genetics. The biological law of everything is that every living thing on the planet has parents, or had parents. Every person you've ever known has biological parents, as does every bird, salamander, or shark you have ever seen. To put it in more precise form, every living thing sprang from some parental genetic information." So what we're seeing here is that scientists and all of us agree that as you were given life, your life came from life, right? So we can start with you and we can trace back, excuse me, we can trace back one generation Your life came from a life that was existed before you. Can we continue to trace that back? Until we get to Adam. He was the first man that we find. Of course, we would find that from the Bible. Whether they agree Adam is the first man or not is immaterial, but they all would agree that there is a first something. How did that first man or that first something, how did it get life? If life comes from life, and we've already acknowledged, excuse me, we've understood that all agree that life comes from life. But yet, as we trace this back, what do we find? That eventually, at some point, what do evolutionists say? Life came from non-life. So here was this little one-celled organism. It wasn't alive, was it? And then all of a sudden, either suddenly or over the course of years, it came alive? Sounds like a fairy tale to me. Remember, we don't believe in fairy tales. But yet, the same people who say they don't believe in fairy tales acknowledge that life comes from life, but we get back to the first being. Isn't it apparent that life came from, it demands a life giver? Who was that life giver? All we need to do is turn to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7, and what do we find? We find an answer. Kind of shocking, isn't it? Man, God breathed into man. He breathed into the nostrils of man the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Life demands a life giver. We can also move to the next idea, and that is design demands a designer. You know, we see all sorts of things in life that becomes apparent. Take a painting. If you look at a painting, if you look at a poem, you look at architecture around. Is it evident that there was a painter who painted the painting? There was a poet who wrote the poem. There's an architect who designed the architecture. One of the big examples is always used in this area too, deals with a watch. You've probably heard the idea of, as intricate as a watch is, there was a watchmaker at the beginning. Or at least at the beginning of the watch being crafted and designed. So what we see is, over the course of the last few thousand years, man has designed millions of things. Very good. Many developments have been made. But you know, in the 6 days of creation, God also designed millions of things in a much shorter time. He designed these things in nature. He designed these in plants and animals and humans. We see the earth with the orbit around the sun. We see the moon and the rising tides and the lowering of them. We see the migratory pattern of birds along the way. These are just a few of the things that we see in nature itself. We see in humans a circulatory system around the heart. We see a respiratory system around the lungs. We see a nervous system and other aspects relating to the brain itself. We see DNA, characteristics that you and I have coming from DNA. Thanks, I'm going to use that. There is much that we see that God has designed. And with this, we can see that our life and much around us is kind of like a well-oiled machine. The more we learn about plants and animals and humans, the more we marvel at how their design fits well with their way of life. And we see that a design is the effect, not of time, not of chance, not unintelligent random accidents that may have happened, but by a purposeful planning and a deliberate action of an inventor or a designer. And so we're seeing that by definition, design demands a designer. And when we talk about the universe, we are talking about God as the designer. Going again to a biblical passage in relation to this, and I think of Psalm chapter 19. If you'd like to turn there, you may. I'm going to read a few verses, about four, I believe. Psalm chapter 19 describes this too. The design. What do the heavens do? The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, night unto night showeth knowledge. As we see these things, they are a testament. They testify to God and his handiwork. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them has he set a tabernacle for the sun. I'll continue with 5 and 6. Which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, rejoicing as a strong man to run a race. His going forth is from the end of the heavens, his circuit unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. This goes to show the design that God has shown in the world. The heavens declaring the glory of God. We are seeing the sun as it rises and as it sets, and the pattern that has been established for the sun. We see in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 4, every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. Design definitely demands a designer. And of course, what some would have you believe, which again is a fairy tale in and of itself, is that big old bang, what did it do? Out of chaos came order. Now that is a fairy tale, if I've ever heard one. And so, we move on to the fourth one that we've mentioned, and that is, intelligence demands an intelligent creator. To me, the idea we find here is very similar to what we saw as far as life. Life comes from what? Life comes from life. Intelligence comes from intelligence. Something that is unintelligent does not produce something that is intelligent. As we see then, we'll briefly mention what intelligence could be defined as. The capacity to acquire knowledge. the capacity to acquire and apply knowledge, or the ability to learn or understand things to deal with new or difficult situations. We can start briefly with the animals. We know there are animals who have intelligence. We can take dogs and we can train them to do useful tasks. We can train them to do tricks that kind of amuse us. Sometimes the tricks may not have a whole lot of benefit, but we kind of enjoy watching the dogs do it. So the dogs can be intelligent in what they do, and again, dogs can go herd animals. They can go get the newspaper for you. They can do things that are useful. We know chimps have a great deal of intelligence as well. We know birds go out and they know how to make their nest and do different things. We know that ants go and they not only ants but squirrels and others go and prepare for winter, prepare for other times. Many examples we could look at as far as some level of intelligence within animals. But what about man? Man, of course, is many, many levels above animals in terms of being an intelligent being. What are some of the great strides that man has continued to go forward in life? We can take medical situations. Man has created artificial hearts and pacemakers. I don't personally know anybody with an artificial heart that I know of, but I know of those who have pacemakers, can certainly extend their life. I think you and I all know people who have artificial hips, who have artificial knees, some who have artificial legs. These are all things that help to not necessarily save a life, but to improve the quality of life. And that certainly has taken quite a bit of intelligence to be able to develop these things. Not only have we made developments in terms of health and medicine, but we know that when it comes to transportation, man has developed cars and airplanes. We've invented radios and televisions, telephone, the electric light bulb, microwaves, computers, all of these things. God has given, or whether we say God has, obviously from this lesson, I'm saying God has given us these intelligence aspects. But we have been able to make many, many advances with this. But it's like we were saying earlier. Where does intelligence come from? Intelligence comes from something that already had intelligence before. Dogs, we're using dogs as an example of intelligence. So as dogs have offspring, do they have an intelligence level? Humans, as we have offspring, do we have an intelligence level? Sure. What about things that have no intelligence, though? If you go out and talk to a rock, you're probably not going to get much response. Does a rock have intelligence? Is a rock going to? Are you going to in some way take a rock and from that move to intelligence? Does water think? You can take dirt that's out in the field, and you can take water and you can combine them together and you can get mud. So while water and dirt may combine to form mud, they're not going to combine to form intelligent mud, though. And whatever we find, whatever we may consider, if it's unintelligent to start with, it's going to remain unintelligent. Where did intelligence come from then? The point I'm making with this is that intelligence demands an intelligent creator. And the point I would make with this is going back to creation itself. We've already discussed how man became a living being. From Genesis 2:7, we find that God breathed into Adam the breath of life, and he became a living being. Not only at that time, though, as God created man, he created him in his what? It starts with an I. He created him in his image. And so what we have is an intelligent creator who created man in his image. What does it mean to create him in his image? Well, one thing it implies is that when he created him and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, he also imparted to him intelligence. Not the same level of intelligence that God himself would have, but I believe that being in the image of God also implies that this intelligent creator created a being and gave him and her intelligence as well. We see then that intelligence demands an intelligent creator. The evolutionist would say, I'm not sure what they would say. Essentially, as you trace it all back, and I think they would agree, intelligence comes from something that's intelligent before. But what about when you get to that very first thing? Just like, how did it gain life? So you have something, that one-celled organism that I spoke of earlier, that had no life and no intelligence. Did it suddenly, or over the course of thousands of years, evolve to have life and intelligence? I think not. I apologize for my throat, but not much I can do about it at this stage. And last, the last idea that we'll discuss briefly relates to morality. Morality demands a moral lawgiver. All would agree, including those who believe and profess evolution, would agree that humans have a sense of right and wrong. There is a sense that murder is wrong. There is a sense that rape is wrong. Raping children, abusing children. Anybody who says that that's okay, there is something wrong. And these were quotes that I'd seen in the article as well. So all, I believe, including evolutionists, as we were saying, agree that there is a sense of innate right and innate wrong. Good and evil. Yes, they may not define all aspects of evil the same way we would, but I think anybody you come across would agree that there are certain things that are evil. With that in mind, what does that actually imply? Well, most would also say that we as humans are different than anything else. Animals don't really have a moral sense of right and wrong. Trees, the last time I checked, didn't have a sense of morality. Rocks. Humans are different. Humans have a sense of morality. Where did that sense of morality come from? Did it just appear? Did morality come out of non-morality? Or did morality coming from a moral lawgiver? In other words, there is a supreme being outside of the human race that has also imparted a sense of morality within you and I who are here today. But not only that, within all humans who have lived over time. And yes, there may be some who have had a very weak sense of morality, but all have had a sense of morality to some degree. And so what we're seeing, again, I've used this example a little bit throughout the lesson. I find it interesting that we come full circle. When you take that billboard as it was posted, one of the ideas from that billboard is, I'm too old to believe in fairy tales. What we see is, when it comes to matter and life and design and intelligence and morality, what do they demand? They demand something outside of humanity to impart these things, to have made them, to have given them life and designed them, given them intelligence and a sense of morality. To not believe in these is to believe in something that is a fairy tale, in essence. Hopefully, as we've shared these ideas with you, many of them you may have already had a sense of, but I appreciate again how succinctly some of these ideas are mentioned, and maybe these are some things that can stick in your mind. And the next time we have an opportunity and visit with someone, we can make some of these points, which are very valid. They may or may not agree with them fully, but I don't know how anyone could disagree with them without believing in a fairy tale. I don't put my faith in any fairy tale. I put my faith in the one who created it all and the one who gave his son to die for your sins and mine. And so, I certainly don't wish to not go to church and to skip church, but I desire to be here because it is an institution that God has given to us, me and you, to be a part of, with Jesus Christ, the one who created it all as well, as our head. This morning we give you the opportunity to allow him to become the Savior of your life as you acknowledge him as the Son of God, also becoming a part of his kingdom and of his church as you confess, and as you are washed in the waters of baptism. Please come, please use these opportunities to strengthen our faith. Come as we stand and sing.